Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. With many environmental problems escalating to crisis proportions, the property insurance industry is running out of money. Question: even if we have money for higher premiums, do we have the right to pollute or destroy in the first place? The insurance industry goes green. Also, a living doorway to the garden with Larry Somke and Dr. Norman Myers, one of the world's leading ecologists.
And we are now entering an era, I believe, of a different sort of security. The threat from the sky is no longer nuclear missiles. It is becoming ozone layer depletion and global warming.
The Environment Show, a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont, and by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York, and this is Bruce Robertson. Your homeowner's insurance policy is paid up and you feel secure. You're covered. But wait, read the fine print. Does your policy cover global warming? Look closely. Anything there about ozone depletion? Probably not. And yet millions of us around the world are suffering the effects of these environmental conditions. Floods, hurricanes, droughts, topsoil loss, and so on. The problem is we are not making the connection between global warming and the loss of our beach house, or greenhouse gases and the Mississippi River flooding. Instead, we submit our claims to the insurance company and wait for a check in the mail. The insurance industry says it is losing billions of dollars, $18 billion in Florida alone from Hurricane Andrew. Insurance industry representatives and environmentalists convened at a conference recently in New York City to look at this situation and stop it. Dr. Jeremy Leggett is scientific director of the Climate Campaign of Greenpeace International. Dr. Leggett is also internationally acclaimed as the author of numerous authoritative works on global warming. Dr. Leggett says the issue of global warming is no longer just a political cause of such groups as Greenpeace. Today, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, a group of international scientists, has refocused the discussion.
And they're telling us on a very strong balance of probabilities that if we continue putting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere at anything like the volumes we do today, we face in the years ahead very definitely, in fact they say certainly, the prospect of global warming. What's uncertain is exactly how much, and the estimates they give us are really very alarming. They're rates of warming that would have a whole range of adverse effects. And among those effects will be things that, of course, will be directly relevant to the insurance industry. We're talking about storm surges from sea level rise. We're talking about the possibility of more intense, perhaps more numerous cyclones, hurricanes as a result of warmer seas and the like, increased droughts, drought-related disasters, and paradoxically also, because of the additional water vapor in the atmosphere, increased inundation. And just on that one point, if we look at recent times here in the States, we've seen the flood of the century. If we go to Asia, we see this year the worst monsoon in a century. And just last year in Pakistan, floods which caused more than $1 billion worth of damage. And it's clear, really, that we have to do something about it, and governments are doing something about it. More than 160 of them have signed the climate convention that was negotiated in the run-up to the Earth Summit in June 1992, and they're in continuing negotiations for improving that convention. And the message that Greenpeace has for the insurance industry is that this is an industry that has a lot at stake. It hasn't so far been involved very much in the debate on the threat assessment exercise of global warming, and of course we think it should be.
Dr. Leggett, considering this litany of events you have just mentioned, or for any one of them really, how can we say conclusively that this or that episode, in fact, is caused by global warming? Might something else, other causes, be involved?
Well, the answer is we can't. And any one disaster of that kind, of course, would weaken the case inordinately. But if we look around the world, there is such a catalogue of floods, droughts, warm years. You know, 1990 was the warmest year since records began, well over a century ago. 1991 was the third warmest, despite the significant cooling effect of the Mount Pinatubo eruption of June of that year. If we look at the collection of these portentous developments, it's quite clear we've got something to worry about. And the form of words we use in Greenpeace is that we believe we're seeing the first signs of climate change. Now, that is not to say that we can 100% prove scientifically that we're seeing it, but we're not alone in suspecting we're seeing it. And if you look in the technical literature in recent months, there's a growing number of government scientists who are sticking their heads out on this issue and saying it's here. Most notably, recently, spokespersons from the Institute of Oceanographic Sciences in the UK, the Japanese Maritime Safety Agency, the Russian Institute of Hydrometeorology, and others. So it's probably here. That's our conclusion. And the more important point anyway, given the long lifetimes of the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere and their known ability to trap heat, is the very strong warning that comes for the future. That's the important point, not whether we can 100% prove that we're seeing a signal today in 1993.
Well, we're here today to talk about how all of this impacts the insurance industry, and we're fortunate to have with us on the line also Franklin Nutter today, who's president of the Reinsurance Association of America. Mr. Nutter, I wonder if you might be able to capsulize for us what you see these issues, how these issues affect your industry.
The insurance industry and government and the public in the United States have grown complacent over the last 25 years with regard to the threat of natural catastrophes. We did not have a major hurricane in Florida between 1965 and 1992 with Hurricane Andrew. We have had moderate but not large earthquakes in California for many, many years. The fact is that the public has moved to coastal areas. They live in high-risk areas. Property values have become much greater as a result of inflationary trends in the 70s and 80s. The insurance industry got a wake-up call, as did government, as a result of the earthquake, the World Series earthquake of 1989, Hurricane Hugo, Hurricane Andrew, the Midwest floods of this year, the northeastern storm that went up the East Coast and Mid-Atlantic states in March of this year. The losses that the industry is paying, some $18 billion in claims in Florida alone as a result of Hurricane Andrew, say to the industry that we need programs of mitigation, better building codes, better enforcement of building codes. The insurance companies need to look at the concentration of risks they have and determine whether or not they are overexposed in areas, Long Island, Florida, a number of the coastal states, in order to ensure their solvency and to make certain they can serve other insurance markets. I don't think the industry has concluded that we have an Armageddon on our hands, but the trend in natural catastrophes is very alarming, and staying lucky, if we can say that we've stayed lucky, is no longer an acceptable policy for government or the industry. We are really only now opening the door to the question of what is causing these changes in weather patterns, and if they are man-made, what should be done about them. Greenpeace has reached the conclusion, and they may be right. I don't know whether they're right, but they are saying, and I think they're right, that the insurance industry has an economic interest in something that's in the public interest, and that is determining whether or not government policy and corporate and personal practices and habits are really threatening the viability of the insurance industry and threatening the economic conditions of our country.
Both Nutter and Leggett agree. In many states, Florida, for example, building codes are in place to minimize the catastrophic effects of floods and hurricanes and such. What is lacking, they say, is proper enforcement. But as Dr. Leggett points out, even proper enforcement of codes is not addressing the real issue.
I think the thing to focus on here is the worst-case analysis, and that is that the climate scientists have got it right or even underestimated the nature of the machine gun fire of catastrophe, as one very senior person in a European insurance company put it to me, and that is what the industry faces. Well, I think what we're already seeing around the world is what we in Greenpeace call a sort of climatic domino effect. Now, if I can illustrate what I mean, in 1991, there were very bad cyclones in the Pacific, and Western Samoa was one of the nations badly affected. Insurers pulled out of Western Samoa after the second of those cyclones, Cyclone Val. And then there was a ripple effect on in Hawaii after Cyclone Aniki. There were big problems for the industry. A number of companies closed down operations or pulled out. Same happened in Florida after Hurricane Andrew, or at least companies wanted to pull out until the state insurance commissioner issued a moratorium. And our point would be to the industry that it's not going to stop there. That's a taste of what, on the big balance of probabilities, it would face in the future if it doesn't do something about it. Now, there are two ways of doing something about it. There's the adaptation route, and that's very important. All these things Mr. Nutt has been talking about are very important for the industry, building codes and also adaptations of the market, increasing rates, putting caps on reinsurance, increasing deductibles so that people have a stake in their own losses, and that's an incentive to keep claims down. All that's terribly important. But what we want the industry to do is look beyond that and recognize the climatic domino effect if we do face a machine gun fire of catastrophe in the future, and argue for mitigation, come to the climate negotiations, lobby governments, lobby other components of the business community to do what's sensible and what manifestly is going to buy security in the future for the industry, and that is ultimately cuts in greenhouse gas emissions.
As we move into the future, Leggett says, no longer will we see an oil company, but a total energy company, Exxon Energy or Arco Energy Systems or something similar. These companies will provide energy from a wide array of sources, including solar and wind, and the insurance industry will be a motivating factor here, as solar and wind are safer to manufacture and distribute, and therefore insurance premiums will be lower, and the same for homeowner insurance. A solar panel has yet to catch fire. How many homes are burned down each year from oil or gas furnaces malfunctioning? In the end, though, it will be a question of social responsibility. Yes, as a beachfront property owner, you do have the right to build and live right on the waterfront. But who is it that will be really paying your insurance bill? Franklin Nutter.
The insurance industry's point of view, I think the reality is we have to accept the decisions people make about where they want to live. Thus, we're seeing dramatic increases in populations in coastal counties and in Florida and in California that reflect public attitudes of being willing to take that risk. The question becomes whether the general taxpayer should subsidize the cost of that through disaster assistance payments and other kinds of federal and state aid when these people have losses.
And what is the answer, to that?
The answer, in our view, the insurance industry's view, is that, in fact, people who live in those high-risk areas should bear the cost of that, that their insurance premiums should reflect the potential losses and actual losses that they experience by those choices, and that we should have require people to have insurance to protect against that. There probably needs to be some federal backup, what we would call a reinsurance program, in the event of a mega catastrophe, but insureds, policyholders, and insurers should be expected to pay proportionate with the risk that they have based upon the decisions to live where they live.
Once again, the old debate of freedom versus responsibility, now taking on a new, somewhat chilling meaning. Dr. Jeremy Leggett, Scientific Director of the Climate Campaign of Greenpeace International, and Franklin Nutter, President of the Reinsurance Association of America, spoke to us from New York City. There, participating in a conference called Climate Change and the Insurance Industry, The Next Generation. The conference was co-sponsored by the College of Insurance, Environmental Technology Telecommunications Limited, and Greenpeace. This is Bruce Robertson. Larry Somke, the environmental gardener, doesn't mean to lead us down the garden path or anything. It's just that, in this case, he made the garden path itself worth a visit. It was not difficult to do. In fact, he wants to walk us through the project so we can do it, too. Hey, Larry, the environmental gardener turned carpenter today, huh?
That's right. I'm putting some finishing touches here on a trellis that we made out of some rough native wood that we found in the woods behind our house. So we're going to use this. We've built this thing. It looks like a big trellis, and we're going to stand this up, and we're going to create an entryway to our back garden. We're trying to create this natural, environmental look in our back garden here in our backyard, and this is going to be the entryway, and we want to keep it looking very nice and natural.
What kind of wood is this?
Well, this is called ironwood. Also, people have called it musclewood.
Very smooth, no bark on it.
Right. It has a real nice texture to it, though. You know, it's brown, looks like a tree, and has a very nice texture. We didn't want to get anything with a lot of bark that would come off. And this was the most unique wood that we could find. Actually, my wife chose this kind of wood, and this was basically her idea to do this thing. And we got wood saws. We didn't get power saws or anything like that. We just have little pruning saws. And we went out into the woods behind our house, cut them down. The kids, Henry and Kit, we all went up there and did it. We've made it into a fun family activity.
Okay, now tell us again what this is going to be, where it's going to be placed. Is a trellis on your walkway?
Yeah, an arbor, a gateway. And we're going to plant it between the house and the garage here, right, sort of in the middle. And as the people come into the house, they'll have to pass through this gateway. And on either side of the arbor, we're going to have a climbing hydrangea that when it blooms will bloom all for the early part of the summer. And then we're going to plant a clematis, a type of clematis that blooms in the fall. We'll have a fall blooming clematis. Then on either side of that, we're going to put in blueberries, bushes which grow up into, you know, 6-foot hedge-like bushes, and it'll be part of our edible landscape. And then, of course, they turn a bright red in the fall. So we've got this whole beautiful landscape all designed around this wooden structure that we cut from the woods behind our house.
And so that will be sort of a natural entranceway into your flowering garden and
right.
your organic garden back
into our backyard. And then we'll have some more native species like the Joe Pye weed I've got over here and some other brush and the perennials that we'll create this, an illusion of walking into a sort of a forest woodland is what I really like people to have that in their backyard so that they can attract birds and butterflies and have a more natural look rather than something that's, you know, kind of clean and sparse.
Okay, well, strengthen it up and we'll walk through next time, Larry.
All right.
Take care.
Larry Somke, the environmental gardener, author of Beautiful Easy Gardens. His newly trellised walkway leads to his home in Hollowville, New York. This is Bruce Robertson. In chapter 16 of his new book, Dr. Norman Myers writes, "An artillery salvo does not serve against soil erosion. Rockets will be unguided when the opponent is acid rain. No nation can now go it alone in a world where pollutants, whether acid rain or greenhouse gases, recognize no frontiers. This amounts to as great a change for the nation-state systems as any since the emergence of the nation-state 4 centuries ago." Myers, who lives in Oxford, England, recently made a rare, brief visit to the States. Looking out the window of his hotel room high over the busy streets of New York City below, Myers talked about his new book titled Ultimate Security, The Environmental Basis of Political Stability.
What I think is distinctively different about my book is that it's drawing the attention of John and Jane Doe Citizen and political leaders, I hope, to a fundamental change that is overtaking our world, our politics, our economics, our relations to each other, the relationships between one country and another, concerning security. Security is one of the most fundamental values and concerns we have, and we are now entering an era, I believe, of a different sort of security. The threat from the sky is no longer nuclear missiles. It is becoming ozone layer depletion and global warming. We should note the nationalist leader, of whom there are lots around the world, who proclaims he won't give away 1 square yard of national territory to a foreign invader, but at the same time allows hundreds of square miles of topsoil to wash away from his country's lands every year. Environmental security addresses the the foundations of our economies, that is climate, vegetation, forests, fisheries, soils, which make very, very major contributions to our material welfare. And this foundation is now being depleted at rates which are far, far in excess than what we've ever known in the past. It's pretty much of a worldwide phenomenon. No nation is free of it. If we give attention to these environmental underpinnings of our daily lives, I believe we shall gain more enduring, more real, more all-round security than we will by the traditional means of fighter planes and tanks.
Part of the challenge facing us, the challenge of how to raise funds for cleanup and restoration of the environment, part of the challenge is deciding where to start. Everyone has a top 10 list of priorities. For Myers, the list should be ordered in just this way.
The main focus for attention and for support funds should be the environmental crisis overall. That means global warming and ozone layer depletion and loss of topsoil and spread of deserts and shrinking forests and mass extinctions, all those put together, because this crisis overall has been described by a good number of political leaders, by Jimmy Carter, Chancellor Kohl of Germany, President Mitterrand. There's a whole long line of them, including Bob McNamara of your country, as the single biggest threat to our future, short of a nuclear exchange. It's on that sort of a scale. But if you want me to pick out one or two, global warming will cause fearful damage to our economies right around the world. It'll impose, it's likely to impose massive droughts in the American Midwest. It may even cause your great grain belt to come unbuckled. Parts of Florida, Louisiana, your eastern coast would disappear under the waves permanently. In some countries like Bangladesh, huge chunks of national territory would be eliminated permanently. That Bangladesh might lose as much as one quarter of its territory to sea level rise. This is a loss greater than it would ever suffer at the hands of a foreign invader. So I'd put global warming top. Second, I would put mass extinction of species, because this is the one environmental problem that is inherently irreversible. When a species is gone, it's gone for good. Whereas in the case of soil erosion, well, we can always allow natural processes to restore the soil cover. Might take a few centuries, but it could be done. We could always fix up the ozone layer in a few centuries. We can stabilize climate in a few centuries. We can push back the deserts. The length of time it will take evolution to repair the damage done to the planetary stock of species will not be a few centuries. It'll be several million years. It'll be at least 20 times longer than humans have been humans as an individual species. The number of people who will live an impoverished world if we allow this mass extinction to proceed will be at least 100 trillion. What we're doing now is a bigger decision taken on the unconsulted behalf of other people, much bigger decision of that sort than any that's ever been taken in the whole course of human history.
While he is eloquent in cataloging the problems, he is also quick to counter the criticism that he is all gloom and doom. The rate of destruction and loss of environmental stability that he describes, he says, presupposes that we will not slow or even reverse our policies of destruction. In fact, he notes, in recent years, there has been a tremendous upsurge of concern, expertise, and action on behalf of environmental protection. We should give ourselves credit. However, there is one area where we should not give ourselves credit, and this, he says, is really the keystone to it all. We'll find out more about this next week as we continue our conversation with Dr. Norman Myers, author of Ultimate Security, The Environmental Basis of Political Stability. It is newly available from W.W. Norton, New York, New York. Until next time, this is Bruce Robertson. And that's our report on the Environment Show this week. Thanks much for joining us. Be sure to tune in next week. We'll do it all again. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-767-1929. Ask for The Environment Show, program number 196. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Shartok, executive producer. This is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York, and by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont.